Hello, and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast all about the galaxy's greatest comic, 2000 AD. I'm Eamon Clark, and for this episode, I'm joined from the Where Eagles Dare podcast, all the way from New Zealand. It's Peter Adamson. Peter, welcome to the book club.
Hello, Eamon. Thank you very much for having me.
No trouble at all. I'm glad we managed to sort this out. It's you're plus 11 hours from me, I think, or something like that.
That's right. Yeah, it's the evening where I am.
And Sunday morning here, but
lovely.
We've got you on to talk about a fascinating book from the Treasury of British Comics. But before that, we start with 2000 AD origin stories. But I guess it might be a Eagle comic origin story first, is it, Peter?
I can give you both if you like.
Go for it.
Sure. Okay. So we really didn't have comics in the house where I grew up, or we weren't comic collectors. So most of the things we had were sort of collected from church and school jumble sales, picked up on a whim from the local dairy. So things like Gold Key reprints, some Spider-Man and Ghost Rider, which I really liked but found hard to follow. And then when I was about 12, comics began to be advertised on TV. I have a dim memory of Eagle being advertised, and one also for, I think, the US reprints of the Dread stories.
Oh, right, yeah.
I remember those ads, and I think I may have picked up the old 2000 AD over that year from those fairs. But I saw Eagle and immediately was drawn to Doom Lord and Dan Dare as an opportunity to get something for myself and start from scratch. And that was my Eagle story, really. I collected it up to around issue 79 or 80, which we've just struck in the podcast.
Oh, right.
And then, awkward pause. And then around about the same time, yeah, I was noticing girls. Also noticed 2000 AD properly. So my first purchased prog was about 319. It's a Sam Slade, it's the Banzai cover, I think, is his war memories. With Samurai Droids on it.
Right, yes, I remember.
Yeah, moving swiftly on. The first ongoing prog was 336, which is Mick McMahon's Slain and the Beltane Giant, which is a lovely, lovely cover, and I still have and still treasure. And then there's several jumping off and jumping on points. 522, I can't believe I jumped off then because I missed all of Zenith and Oz and so many fantastic things. Jumped back on again at 700 and then off again at 917. Sort of, I'm one of those early to mid 90s casualties, etc.
Oh, right. Okay. And I'm sort of fascinated because it's about, I think from listening to your podcast, it took about three months for the comics to reach New Zealand, I think, from here. Is that right?
Yeah, two and a bit, I think. I've sort of done a little bit of alignment in sort of researching, you know, what issues and progs I remember. And I think the general rule of thumb that Dave and I follow is about 12 weeks, 11 or 12 weeks.
Right.
All of the seasonal themes of progs and issues completely irrelevant by March, you know, to see a Christmas issue or a summer special. It was all wonky, but you live with that.
Yeah. I had David Bishop on the podcast a while back. I never asked him this one. Did New Zealand or does New Zealand have its own comics at all?
Not so much. We have a history of comics. We're still sort of discovering some comics creators and a bit of a spruik for another a podcast. I was on the Comic Scene podcast a few weeks back with Philip Vaughan, and we talked about one of the comics I've been reading, which is a collection by a local artist called Dylan Horrocks, and he, in his book, covers a lot of the sort of nascent comics history in New Zealand from about 1940s onwards. But otherwise, no, not really. You could pretty much count the comics that New Zealand had on the palm of your hand, and they would be usually one-offs. We have a stronger history, I think, of editorial cartoons, and probably our greatest export in that regard is Murray Ball, who created a very farming-oriented, comic called Foot Rot Flats, which even got turned into a movie and had a soundtrack, and it was a real cultural phenomenon through to about the 1980s. And he had also contributed to Punch, back in the day, back in the sort of 60s and early 70s. So we've got a wee bit of a history here. And of course, one of our great grandfather comic artists is David Lowe, who was published in the UK in the 40s, I think, and apparently made it on the list of people who a certain German leader at the time really didn't like because of his satire. So, yeah, small but actual is our comics history.
Oh, fascinating. Okay. Well, we're going to talk about 1980s comics bit. Tell us about the book you've chosen, which I think is from the Treasury of British Comics, isn't it?
It is. I'm really excited, Eamon, to have The 13th Floor by Wagner and Grant, writing as Ian Holland, and out by Jose Ortiz. It's a beautiful collection. It's volume one, so I'm really looking forward to matching it up with a volume two in the near future.
Excellent. So The 13th Floor, from that short-lived run of Scream comic from 1984, which we've talked about on the podcast before, because we've done Monster and we've done the Dracula file, 15 issues of Scream, and then the 13th Floor is, of course, one of the strips that made the leap into The New Eagle, which is your specialist subject, where it carried on for quite a while, didn't it?
It did, yeah. It's funny. I had thought that the jump off from from Scream 15 through to Eagle. Oh, crikey! I forget the issue number. I thought that it was pretty immediate, but in fact, it was almost like a New Zealand delay. There was about two months.
Was that right?
July cancellation, and it appears in sort of September of that year. In Eagle, so
issue 128, it says here at the front of the book.
Yeah
So from June 84 to September 84, it says, or something like that. Yeah. A New Zealand like delay, as you say.
Yes. I was going to say, we actually did get Scream in New Zealand. I have, again, very misty memories of that. I didn't pick it up, so I'm still discovering it now, and I remember a sole total of one issue of Scream, which appropriately I read in the bowels of the opera house of my hometown while I was in a scout gang show. It looked pretty good, but I have to say, I also had Progs 361 at home, and that's the Haunting of Sector House 9 and You Only Live Twice and Slane's Dragon Heist, so no competition.
No, absolutely. Oh, well, tricky one for Scream anyway, up against such competition. Yeah. So this is The Treasury of British Comics from 2018. I've got the hardback collection in front of me. Have you got the hardback or the softback there?
I have the digital.
You got the digital. Mm. And as you say, it's Grant and Wagner writing together. Jose Ortiz, we're going to talk about. Letters, Mike Peters. And, of course, the editor was Mr. Ghastly McNasty himself, Ian Rimmer, I believe, who provides one of the introductions in this book. So set it up for us. what's the story of The 13th Floor? Tell us about the basis for this almost classic British horror comic, in a way.
Yeah, so The 13th Floor is largely about Max, who is a computer superintendent of Maxwell Towers, which I assume is housed in London. It's a futuristic but present-day council tower, and he oversees almost everything in the tower, and, to quote him, the well-being of his tenants is his prime concern. So in his features, he's got an integrated function module, which has something that we would probably these days call a virtual reality generator, in some manner of speaking, and you can create artificial virtual environments, which is his 13th floor, within which he meets out torments and punishments to anyone who threatens him or his residence. So it's a lovely, ghastly, urban gothic tale.
Fantastic. Yes, Max, the murderous computer of the 13th floor of Maxwell Towers. And it's a great setup for a 1980s comic. I mean, we were just sort of getting used to the idea, I suppose, of, you know, computers being in charge of things. And there's a little bit of hand-waving, I suppose, by John Wagner, Alan Grant, with the integrated function module or whatever it was, that had a slight short circuit in it that gives Max even more sentience than he's been programmed with, I guess.
Those were the days.
Absolutely, as murderous computers, but protecting the his tenants at all costs, I guess, as you say. So we've got these stories. I guess they're about 3 or 4 pages each one, is that right? Something like that?
Yeah. About 3. I had originally thought, in seeing it, that it was going to be a murder of the week, essentially, but it's a lot more sophisticated than that.
Yes, it sort of starts like that, but as you say, sort of like they have to do some widening out of the world in the story, I guess, because just murder of the week becomes a bit repetitive in a way, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah. I mean, Max literally overextends himself.
Yes.
He has to take it outside.
Yeah,
he
does.
And that complicates things, yeah.
Yeah, because after the first few episodes of bodies being found in the elevator, it's always the elevator, isn't it? That the police do become a little bit suspicious, as I guess they would.
Yes, quite. And then he's aided and abetted by one of his tenants. He develops a knack for hypnotism, and finds one of his tenants, Bert Rudge, who's a bricklayer, to coerce or influence to do his work outside the walls of Maxwell Tower. And it's lovely. I think the irony is that, you know, you start thinking that Max is just a computer, but he sort of humanizes himself along the strip, and he almost meets his match in Bert, who fatally takes one of his instructions far too literally, and there Max's troubles really begin.
Yes. So Bert is almost literally the muscle for Max, isn't he? He becomes, you know, his flesh and blood limbs, as it were. He's also got Jerry, his sort of programmer and controller, who lives in the tower block as well.
Mm.
But yeah, how convenient that the computer can hypnotize Jerry and Bert.
Although there's a lovely, with spoilers of course, but there's a lovely scene between Jerry and Max when the curtain starts to shift, and very happily, I think it's a triumph in as much in Ortiz's work as it is in Wagner and Grant's scripting. It's a lovely, just a lovely wee piece.
Yes, fantastic stuff. Give us just some of the sort of virtual nightmares that Max creates for some of his victims, just to sort of fill us in on what we're talking about. Because obviously it is a horror comic, you know, it does have that weekly sort of terror that was sort of such a part of Scream, particularly at the start.
Well, there's a flavour for everybody, Eamon. What's your fear?
Because absolutely.
There are rats. There's a wonderful cemetery of skeletal zombies. There are giant cockroaches, centipedes, alligators, a boa constrictor. There are spiders. In fact, a spider tattoo comes to life.
Yes, and very Ortiz, memorably, the spider tattoo, yes.
Ortiz draws some lovely, dusty, grimy-looking cobwebs. And I guess, I don't know about you, but a personal favourite of mine are the debt collectors, the little bowler-headed evil dwarfs.
They're fantastic. They... They appear on the front cover of the volume and they crop up several times when a debt collector is put into the 13th floor. So yes, these little sort of demonic pinstripe and bowler hatted dwarves who stalk him through a sort of computer game maze. And then they crop up again throughout the book a few times, and they're always memorable. you're quite right. I did really enjoy those whenever they appeared. And it's like a sort of horror film anthology in a way, one of those sort of portmanteau films where you've got several horrors all in one.
Yes, it's almost like a little morality play. And it makes Max's character rather, as I said, rather sophisticated. He's not vindictive in and of itself, and he's not evil, but he has a very firm moral streak. He'll tolerate a fair bit of naughtiness, but I think once you've gone past one warning, he'll double down very, very quickly, and it gets really imaginative after that. It's wonderful.
Yes, he does play fair. He gives them a warning. They inevitably ignore it. I suppose, you know, the episode where somebody says, "Oh, all right then," and leaves the building, that doesn't happen. And then, yes, he rapidly escalates from then on with all sorts of wonderfully depicted horrors. And as you say, it's a very sort of, I suppose if you're writing, you know, a horror comic for kids in the 80s, and we know that one of the things that the creators of Scream had to sort of wrestle with was this fine line between something that was going to be too horrific and upset the parents and upset the media, like Action had in the 70s. So having it, you know, it's a sort of moral story. I mean, I often think this about, well, I mean, it's, you know, it's well known, I guess, about horror films and all sorts of horror fiction, that they can be quite moral things, you know, that... Once you step off the straight and narrow, that's when the horror happens to you. And that's what happens with the Max and the 13th Floor. And I guess, as I say, it helps for Scream and then later on for Eagle to sort of keep just the right side of true horror, in a way, I suppose, for children's comics.
I think we could probably classify a lot of the monsters in the 13th Floor, and I guess in a broader sense in Scream, in a very sort of safe bracket of recognisable monsters. So alongside giant creepy crawlies, you've got, well, there's Dracula, of course, and the Frankenstein monster is the recognisable Frankenstein monster. So they're not really dredging any new horrors up. And I guess that makes them a little bit more manageable and a little bit more relatable to kids. With the 13th Floor, they stretch out a little bit, but even then, sort of the tropes are very sort of Hammer horror, Gothic, rather than any sort of fevered imagination of modern horror might bring up. I mean, this is not torture porn, thankfully.
No, there is an executioner with an axe, but you never see him actually wield it, do you?
Well, there's a really nice twist in that, which I'm sure we'll come to.
But yes, it is, as you say, a lot of recognisable horror tropes. And then, of course, there's the giant bugs, there's the snakes, memorably spiders. There's also a very memorable, I thought, scene of a guy sort of on a raft in the ocean, and then he's pursued by sharks and so on. That's very well depicted by Jose Ortiz as well. So, yes, it is just the right side of the horror line. And I think in Ian Rimmer's introduction, he does mention that John Wagner and Alan Grant were experts at keeping it just the right side of the line that the Scream couldn't cross. And that, in fact, I think he says they needed no censorship. They knew what they, you know, they knew so experienced, they knew what they were doing and where the line was for the title, I think is what he says.
That's fantastic that they needed no editorial, you know, balance. But as you say, experience, their output at this stage is phenomenal. It's absolutely phenomenal.
Yes, they're just writing everything, aren't they? Sort of John Wagner, Alan Grant at this stage in British comics. They're writing the whole thing.
I have a theory. And I think we've been lied to all this time, Eamon. Then there really is a T.B. Grover, an Ian Holland, a Keith Law, a John Howard, an F. Martin Kandor, and an Alan Trench out there very angrily, having been denied their moment of glory.
Yes.
But even an Eagle of the time, the Eagles that we're doing, you will see Wagner and Grant's names in pretty much half of the issue, or on any given issue. Significantly with Eagle, you know, they're providing Doomlord and Mannix and Joe Soap, and Scorpio and House of Damon, and that just they're just bobbing along while producing who knows what in 2000 AD and Battle as well. It's incredible. With the 13th Floor, I would have expected them to have run out of fuel very, very quickly, but instead they bring in these marvellous wee twists. I'm really quite hyped for the next volume.
Yes, well, I'll ask you about the next volume in a little while. But as you say, because we also get an introduction from Alan Grant in this book where he mentions that they ended up writing under about 14 different aliases because IPC felt that they were writing so much material they had to start using pseudonyms. But yes, they were producing such... Their rate of output was remarkable to keep churning these out all the time. I wonder when they started the 13th Floor, did they think it would be as long-running as it became? Because as you say, they have to sort of widen the world out, and Max has to become much more devious and manipulative to stop arousing the suspicions of the police as things go on, particularly Sergeant Ingram, who keeps coming back and back to the building.
Poor Sergeant Ingram.
Yes.
I guess the fact that they broaden that canvas out very, very quickly is telling in itself. Either they peg very quickly that they can't really sustain this model, or that it was always part of the plan. But what a great plan it is to have the reader not just root for the main character, who's, as we've discussed, morally ambiguous. but sort of be concerned for him as well. He's a character in the story more than just being an omniscient dispenser of justice.
And we should mention, of course, he gets a sort of depiction of Max, that we see this screen with these sort of flashes or slashes of light and across it, which is makes up a sort of almost demonic face on the computer screen as well for Max, often appearing on the front page of each issue.
It's like a primitive emoji.
1980s emojis, there you go.
Yeah, and I wonder whether Duncan Jones had been reading 13th Floor when he concocted some aspects of Moon years later.
Gertie is the computer, I think, is that right? Or
yeah, with that sort of the emoji face.
Yes.
I love that aspect. It's you would think it's very, very limiting, but there are two sort of spark-like eyes and a sort of a jagged sort of lightning bolt mouth, which occasionally gets twisted up and moved to the bottom of the screen for different expressions. But the way that Ortiz portrays Max as a feature of his own landscapes is a wonderful sort of splash panel. He doesn't really do splash panels, but there's a wonderful splash with a motorway scene within the 13th floor, and Max is just sort of half peering out from behind, I think, Maxwell Tower, which is on the side of this motorway, which has these, you know, cars full of skeletons on it about to mow somebody down. But it's a very witty way of portraying him. And for a very limited screen, they mine a lot out of it.
Yes, they do.
I want the T-shirt as well.
Yes. get that on a T-shirt. Yes, please.
Yeah.
So let's talk about José Ortiz. You know, one of the great Spanish artists who worked on British comics, particularly in the 80s. Because I know he'd worked for, in America, he'd worked for Warren Comics in the 1970s, where he'd done horror comics there. I think the comic was called Creepy or something like that, that Warren
did. Yeah, that seems to be the case. And he was doing sort of Western war-type material in Spain before that. But the Warren pedigree is really useful, not only in the 13th floor, but in some of the things he was doing in Eagle as well. He's in Eagle from the get-go, having done the Tower King to begin with, and then the House of Damon, which is another Alan Grant script. And actually seems to share a little bit of DNA with the 13th floor. You've got a sort of a malevolent being overlooking a building, being able to sort of create a dreamlike environment inside it. I hadn't really thought about that, but that work in Eagle is lovely, and it's brush and pen. So it's very flowy, and it's got lots of mid-tones. When we get to Scream in the 13th floor, it's much more sort of black line, scratchy, as we also see in 2000 AD, of course, with his stint on Rogue Trooper. So very different styles, but fantastic choice for this sort of chiaroscuro horror script.
Yes, and of course it is. I mean, it's a black and white strip, obviously, and yeah, as you say, that style suits it. He brings in all these sort of familiar horror tropes, which would have, I suppose, been, you know, familiar but also scary for the readers at the time. And then he just sort of, he does some wonderful things with his figure work, his facial expressions. He's pretty good at hair, I think, as well. You know, all the characters have wonderful hair in various different representations. There's quiffs, there's skinheads, there's even Sergeant Ingram, who looks like a sort of 1950s police copper. But
yeah,
wonderful stuff.
It's got a wonderful moustache, which is almost a character in itself. It sort of, you know, beetles its way over his top lip.
Yes.
And he's not scared to draw, you know, the imperfections, the wrinkles and the sags. And there's a lot of character in his faces. I do appreciate that.
And of course, these little demonic dwarves with their bowler hats, their rolled up brollies or pitchforks at one point, they're great stuff as well. And I've just flicked to a page as the zombies in the graveyard. As I say, I do particularly love the bit where it's the guy adrift in the ocean on a raft, but also the spider tattoos. It's wonderful stuff, actually.
Yeah. I've found there's something new to admire every time. I like zombies, that they're not the modern zombie, that they're not sort of the old sort of Haitian style zombie either. There's something in between. They're an animated, almost skeleton or mummy, and that's a nice wee twist, or nice wee take. And when he gets around to drawing Satan, it's like straight out of Dennis Wheatley. Yeah, he's got the cloven hooves and the horns, and he also has the bowler hatted dwarves, but they've got little devil's horns on their bowler hats.
Yes, that's right.
It's lovely.
Yeah, Satan does turn up in this comic. Yes, that's right. Jose Ortiz gets to write it. John and Alan writing an appearance of Satan. And I think, remind me, there's a certain podcast that described Jose Ortiz as the Eagle Comics Carlos Esquerra. Is that right?
Now, that was not me. That was my my co-host. But right. Yeah, he's look, I think where Dave is drawing the comparison is that he is ever reliable. I think we probably run the phrase "knocks it out of the park" into the ground in our first six or seven episodes ourselves, because he's just so thoroughly consistent, and he can pretty much draw anything, and that's a fantastic asset to have in a fledgling title, and you know, it works twice for Eagle and for Scream as well. So, and plus, of course, he's Hispanic, so there's another comparison there.
Yeah, and yes, as we've talked about before, that, you know, there may have been something about the exchange rate at the time that made it so lucrative for Spanish artists or European artists to be working on British comics. And as you say, he can draw anything. He can, presumably, he was, you know, like Carlos, he was reliable and quick. Carlos often described himself as the fastest pen in the West, and as I presume Jose Ortiz must have been quite similar, because he was knocking these out, and yet the sort of quality never drops off. If anything, no. As the series progresses, I think he gets even better and better.
I'm interested in the progression of the art going forward, because I think even in this issue, this collection, towards the end, his personality has become a little bit more caricature-like. I think that's in part the writing. I think Wagner and Grant give him a bit of a gift in there. And he spreads things out a little bit, so the style becomes a bit looser. It's not as tight and focused, which is not a criticism. It just gives us another side to his work. But in those panels, it reminds me of the likes of, say, John Ridgway or Steve Parkhouse, who do very similar, very concentrated, dense work, but can sort of open it up from time to time as well. I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, it's terrific stuff. I mean, I'm flicking to the back of the book now. Just found the page where a guy is being menaced by, it's almost Shaco, the polar bear from 2000 AD. In fact, I think
you got Hookjaw as well, if you like.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Okay. Now, I'm not familiar with his work on Eagle. You've mentioned the Tower King and the House of Damon. Tell me a little bit about those stories before we come back to the 13th floor. They were, when the Eagle sort of started up, they were there from early on, were they?
Yes. So the Tower King was Alan Hebden, and it was essentially, it's a post-apocalyptic world. There's been a massive, I guess, an electromagnetic pulse, you know, the EMF, has struck the planet, and everything's been thrown into chaos because it's the 1980s. And so the Tower King is Mick Tempest, who resides in London, actually in the Tower itself, and leads a resistance movement, or tries to keep the peace with while everything else is falling to pieces around them. And that's like a Mad Max set in London story, and it's a wee ripper, but it's just pretty much action focused, with some wonderful opportunities for Ortiz to sort of be imaginative with everything from to locomotives to Sherman tanks to Chieftain tanks. So it's an important distinction to traction engines, and you've got the typical Mad Max sort of, you know, mutants in the sewers and punks with filed teeth and everything, and then the House of Damon is more of a ghost story, but it's got a nice twist which had us thinking of a particular Judge Dredd epic, which I won't spoil. But that's pretty much set in an old mansion. An architect buys it and for his wife, and they step from the house, and there's a malevolent presence which just toys with them for the next 20 or so issues. And things get very, very imaginative there. Giant caterpillars and Vietnam flashbacks and everything. And I think the last one before the Scream integration is The Fifth Horseman, which I think again is Alan Hebden. And that's more of a sort of an airport novel thriller. A wealthy entrepreneur adventurer stumbles across a Dan Brown type conspiracy around the Four Horsemen, and Ortiz is producing some lovely work there as well. But as I say, everything here is pen and ink with some nice washes, and because Eagle had a different photo, so it's a different paper quality in its early issues. It allowed that style very much so. I guess comparisons could be drawn with maybe Star-Lord.
Right, oh
which
yes.
Which had a different photo stock. Well, I keep saying photo, which had a different paper stock. And so those mid-tones worked really, really well on the page. And when Eagle dropped the photo strips, it also went to the sort of the bog-standard newsprint format, and the style of artwork changes for the main artists, including Ortiz, to accommodate that.
That's interesting. I hadn't really thought about that, but you're quite right. Of course, 2000 AD at this time, 1984, is still on the, as you would say, the bog standard pulp paper. And then Star-Lord, of course, had better paper stock, but probably, I guess, been too expensive. And then Eagle had done something similar. They had better paper than Scream, because Scream was that same sort of cheap and readily available paper stock, let's say. So Eagle was slightly better, and that allowed them to do different things with the artwork. I hadn't really thought about that. As I say, I'm not as familiar with the Eagle as you are, obviously. There's a lot of catching up for me to do.
Indeed. I guess most importantly, that paper stock probably allowed for better reproduction of photo strips, which were the defining look for the first 78 issues of Eagle. That you had some very strong stories which were presented by actors being photographed in certain situations. When Eagle again drops to the newsprint stock, everything that's sort of still being photographed, this is the Lucky Six photographs of readers sort of sending them a picture of themselves, and the quality really, really drops. And it's a shame, but it's what it is.
The economics of making comics.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, turning back to the 13th floor for a moment, because as we've mentioned, it did the 15 issues of Scream, and then, of course, it disappears for 3 months, and then it comes back. And I guess I'm looking at, in my book, page 65, which I think is where the break happens, and so they do a sort of catch-up page, presumably for readers of the Eagle, the 13th floor, the story so far, which reintroduces Max and Jerry and some of the horrors, and then just basically picks up, I think, almost with the same panel that it had sort of ended with in the last Scream, and then they're off and running again.
That's right. Wally Skegg, the protection racket.
Yes.
yeah, it's very confident, but I guess that one panel is pretty much all you need to know. At this stage, the concept's not being tested too much. And even if you do have to pick up the fact that, you know, Max has often maybe won too many people and he's had to cover his tracks once, it's not an uncomfortable and jarring realization. You know, it could be covered very easily with a couple of lines of dialogue, which is what they do here. But happily, you know, Mr. Skeggs' misadventures in the bowels of Maxwell Tower lead to much bigger things. And yeah.
Yes, and it's off in the Eagle then as well. Yeah,
indeed. I love the there's a bit of integration there. I think further on, Eagle absorbs Tiger, which was probably a distressing thing for poor Barry Tomlinson, because I think Tiger was a bit more of a baby of his with sports. But Eagle, of course, was when Eagle absorbs Tiger, Max virtually steps out of the frame and welcomes the Tiger readers to Eagle, and sort of has to pause and refresh us again. And he does this later in this volume as well. Of course, that brings us to another thing, is that Max ends up editing Eagle for a while.
I know, he thinks he has a life well beyond Maxwell Towers, yes. And because in the later parts of the story, he would go on to work in different buildings, I believe.
Mm. Yes, he enters the retail sector and goes to work in Pringles, which I guess is a large department store, and he's the store computer. I have to say, Eamon, I'm not as familiar with those stories.
That's in the future for Where Eagles Dare.
That's in the future, yes. Indeed. I'm keeping my powder dry.
Okay, we will come to that.
Indeed.
One other question about Max, and particularly the 13th floor as a virtual reality, I don't think it's answered in this book, or maybe at all, but where do the people go in the 13th floor? Because a couple of times Max is switched off, and anybody who is unlucky enough to be in his virtual reality at the time he's switched off, they just cease to be, I believe.
He's not a big one for backups, in other words. So yeah, that happens notably with one of the main characters, as it were, and Max gets the hardest of reboots, and this poor chap's, because he's living in that virtual environment quite happily, is gone, or we're led to believe is gone. And I'm assuming that because this episode ends on a cliffhanger, another character may well fall the same fate, certainly being debated. It's an interesting thing, because there are times when it seems that the 13th floor is purely a virtual environment. People who are thrust into it can sort of essentially deny its reality. And for the most part, when people die, they're in the lift. You know, they have a heart attack because they've been terrified to death or something like that. But we do have this notable exception. So I guess you have to believe that it's not just a virtual environment, that there is maybe something happening there with dimensions.
Yes, weird.
I don't know.
Yeah, I know. Parallel worlds, who knows? Parallel universes.
Yep.
But as you say, he does get the hardest of reboots a couple of times when people say, almost before we knew the phrase, have you turned it off and turned it on again?
Yep.
Yes, and something's badly fused in your integrated function module, Max. I'd better get it seen to. Max says, I'm sure that's hardly necessary, Jerry. Yes, I'm still working perfectly well.
Yes, be careful where you're going.
Yeah.
Max can control Alt and Delete.
So it's terrific stuff. From this first volume, any particular episodes or some of the running stories that particularly stood out to you? Will you have favourites in there?
I do have favourites, unfortunately. I mentioned the highway encounter of Mr. Nelson, who is nasty enough to hit and run some poor wee puppy in front of Maxwell Towers. And his comeuppance is quite sort of urban in itself. He's essentially mowed down by cars, which sounds nastier than it actually is. But I feel bad for saying I enjoyed that one. And the cliff top to raft to sharks to desert island to giant crabs episode that you mentioned earlier, Eamon, is also lovely.
It's terrific, but isn't it?
There are some lighter ones. There's Cheesy, who's a sort of a would-be chopper. He's a spray can vandal, who gets on the wrong side of Max and ends up in a New York skyline. I'm a sucker for a skyscraper.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah, because it ends in a nice way. Anyway, I get the feeling that Cheesy actually has a pretty good future, or at least a stable future ahead of him because of Max.
Yeah.
And then the aforementioned Sergeant Ingram, he's just torture upon torture upon torture. However, for me, it's probably Harry Ferguson who enters the story, a nasty piece of work, and Max puts him through the ringer in a grotesque and hilarious vignette. So he's the criminal ne'er-do-well, comes in with a gun, tries to get shelter with one of his old mates, and when that doesn't work, takes his wife hostage. Max intervenes and frees the woman, and then it's payback time for Harry, and it looks like he's going to be led to an execution on a chopping block. And the axe is raised, and of course you'd expect it to fall, but then Grant and Wagner and Max, they pull back, and they pull back, and they pull back, and then it gets really surreal.
Oh dear, yes.
he gets his neck stretched,
yes.
Pulls the head off a hag, through the imps and bowler hats, and he ends up being used as a swing bridge. Oh, it's completely bonkers.
It is bonkers, and it's wonderful and beautifully depicted by Jose Ortiz.
Yes.
I'm looking at those pages now, and they are some of the most memorable in this particular volume. Yeah, wonderful stuff.
I almost wonder whether Pat Mills slipped in and did this episode while the other two were away at the pub. There's an early Nemesis the Warlock vibe to it,
yes.
I think.
Yeah. And also the masked executioner is almost Torquemada like, isn't he? Yeah. Wonderful stuff. Yeah, that is memorable. I did have, in fact, I still have an earlier, I think the Hibernia Press did some collections of the Scream issues of the 13th Floor.
Yes.
And yeah. I think the cover they used for the first collection was of the tattooed thug Spider with his tattoo coming alive.
Yeah.
So that one I thought was particularly memorable for me. Whenever I open the Kindle, I see that image. but I also, as you say, I love the Harry Ferguson episode is terrific, but the Lost at Sea, in fact, all of them. I mean, as you say, the New York skyline with poor old Cheesy plummeting, and even do a look up there. Is it a bird? Is it a plane? Nah, it's some gooky kid with a spray can.
Yeah. Talk about being brought down to earth. Yeah,
absolutely. Very memorable and just beautiful work by Ortiz. It's just terrific. So yeah, I'm delighted to have this volume in front of me. So let's play the wonderful Grail Page game. I didn't check beforehand whether any of Ortiz's art still survives and in collection at all, but if it did survive and we had the limitless virtual reality budget that Max presumably can afford for us, which page or pages would you want to hang in your collection?
Oh, I think in this collection, it's pages 91 and 92. So this is poor, I say loosely,
yeah.
Harry Ferguson, whose neck's been stretched, and he's had to quickly coil it back up again and run with it, presumably flopping around while he's being chased by a crowd of torch-brandishing ne'er-do-wells, and then gets flung across a chasm to be used as a suspension bridge. It's just it just stops the terror and turns it into something banal, and it's lovely work. I'm wondering whether on the script page Ortiz was just told to draw an old bridge, but he draws the ricketiest, most primitive, most characterful bridge.
Absolutely.
Bridge stump. It's poetry. It was really hard, Eamon, to pick one because, as I said earlier, there aren't really many in the way of sort of splash pages in this, and I think it's the economy of the script. So I had to pick something which just sang, and I think I've got it, and specifically 92.
Marvellous. I mean, he is like some sort of demented Mr. Fantastic with his stretched neck.
I'm more of an elongated man.
Right, okay. There is the hooded figure of death who turns out to have Max's face under the cowl and then does this wonderful thing with the sort of throwing Harry's head across the bridge. And then the work on, you know, like when he's running through the sort of village streets, just the architecture on that, and then the bridge, and just what he does with little sort of dashes of ink in the sky above the bridge, fantastic. It's all lovely. So this is going to be slightly weird because I love a title page in these comics. So I picked page 90, which is the title page of that particular episode. Of the 13th floor, there is Harry on the block. There is the executioner with his axe poised. There's Max and Maxwell Towers in the background, as we often saw on the title page. And it's got a wonderful sort of old EC Comics horror feel to it. Before, before John Wagner, Alan Grant and Jose Ortiz just literally pull back and make it even more horrific, if that's possible, in a sort of crazy way. So that's an interesting one. I don't think it's ever happened before on the podcast, but we've got a run of 90, 91 and 92, and we will hang those in the virtual art gallery of the Mega City Book Club.
Fantastic. Do you think on page 90 there's a Ghastly McNasty cameo?
I think so, yes. Off with his head, there he is in the crowd, I think. Yes, the editor making its own appearance. wonderful stuff.
Lovely.
So, yeah, it is terrific. What a volume. And what work by Jose Ortiz. Plus, of course, Wagner and Grant, who were just producing work of such quality, but so sort of prolific behind all their pseudonyms. Maybe they had Max working for them as well.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
So the first volume of The 13th Floor is available from, obviously, 2000 AD and all good bookshops. It's $14.99 in paperback, $9.99 in digital, or there was a limited edition hardback, which I think is still available at $19.99, which I must admit I plunged for. I couldn't resist. It is wonderful. Do you go for mostly digital over there in New Zealand, or do you still get some of these hard copies coming across?
We get the soft covers in the local comic shops, but such is the tyranny of distance that the digital was really the way to go. And I think the same has gone for Dave as well. I'd love to get the hard copy at some stage. I think it would just look wonderful on the shelf.
Fantastic.
With a
T-shirt as well, yes, of course. And as you say, it is volume one, so there's more to come from the Treasury of British Comics. And the story of Maxwell Towers and of Max will widen out even further, I gather, from some of the background reading I've been doing. But as again, this is all still to come in the world of Where Eagles Dare podcast, I guess.
Yes, indeed. I think, actually, we'll probably start looking at Scream by our current rate, probably around about Halloween this year, which seems quite fitting. But we won't encounter the 13th floor for a wee while yet, sadly. So it's been really nice to sort of have this opportunity to look in advance.
Splendid. So let's turn to guest projects and tell us indeed all about Where Eagles Dare, the podcast, for anybody who's not familiar with it, and they should be. Who is your co-host, and how did you come up with this idea?
So my co-host is the lovely David Renane. He's been a friend of mine for about 25 years now, and it was Dave's idea, really. We did have another podcast we were running called Beyond the Sofa, which largely dealt with Doctor Who, although we did sort of branch off into other sort of tele-fantasy from time to time. And that has been on hiatus for a little while. We wrestled with the most recent series, but at the same time, I think Dave was ahead of me in getting a bit restless and said, you know, it would be really, really good to have a look at a comic. And I was aware of Space Spinner 2000 and said, oh, you really want to probably listen to this first. Conrad and Fox have been very lovely in allowing us to borrow some of their format. And so we've been looking at Eagle from issue to issue, roughly about 1 month of issues at a time from the very beginning. And we're just up to issues 78 and 79, so we're about to end that early run of photo strips and this big format change, as mentioned. it's been really interesting looking at Eagle in comparison to 2000 AD, which for years was my first love and still has a very firm place in our hearts. But Eagle is quite a different comic. And I think there have been times where we've sort of lent in a little bit more in terms of its sympathies and what it's trying to achieve rather than immediately putting it up against the Galaxy's Greatest. And I think that's the way we'll continue to look at Eagle. It's its own thing, but and occasionally it just has this magical elements in it, whether it's the 13th Floor or Doom Lord or House of Damon. It's been really enjoyable, and we'll be at it for a while. I think we're moving slower than Space Spinner 2000. It pains us to say,
right?
Here it is.
When did the Eagle start? What year was that?
Yeah, so that was 1982.
It was 82, right, yes.
Mm, yeah, and it ran until about 1994. And by the time you get to 1990, Eagle's actually collected a few scalps. So Scream was the first of the IPC comics to be merged into it. And then after that, there was Tiger and ultimately other titles like Battle. And so it collects strips along the way. And I guess the 13th Floor is probably the longest running of those imports, although it has... It collects Death Race and Death Wish and Billy's Boots and even Charlie's War in its later years. So it's an interesting sort of time capsule in a way as well.
The old Hatch, Match and Dispatch model of
yes,
British comics, yes.
Yeah, well, I think the irony is that somewhere in its history, now if I remember this correctly, the original Eagle was eventually swallowed up by Lion, which then got devoured by Valiant, which I don't think went into Battle. So by the time that the new Eagle absorbs Battle, it's essentially eaten itself.
Right.
it's come full circle. I think that's how it goes.
Right.
Dave's better at it than I am.
And
yeah.
Tell me about the photo strips, because I'd had that, I think, common misconception before listening to your podcast that the photo strips were a sort of budgetary thing, that they were fairly cheap to do. But I gather they weren't that cheap to do, and it was a deliberate style choice for the new Eagle.
I believe it is. I've not fully read Barry Tomlinson's comic strip hero book. But he talks about the genesis of Eagle, and it sounds very much like he was saying that they wanted a point of difference, and that he recognised that photo strips had done quite well in some girls' titles, and I think they were mainly DZ Thompson titles. I think Jackie was one of them, but they were quite untested for the boys' comic market, and Eagle is probably the most notable. I know that 2000 AD dips its toe into that
yes.
a couple of times. But by all accounts, it's not a cheap enterprise. I guess you're paying photographers, you're paying for their time, you're getting actors, and sometimes you're scouting locations and costumes and so forth. And they make a lot of mileage out of what was then King's Reach Tower in the contemporary stories. But then they're also doing period pieces like Jake's Platoon and the House of Correction, which are World War II stories, and most ambitiously, Walk or Die, which we're really enjoying right now, but it's purportedly set in the Canadian wilderness and not Hampstead Heath with a few duck ponds. But they make a lot of mileage out of what they've got, and they've got some very talented artists working with them with the camera. It's really nice to sort of go online and see the likes of Sven Einstein and Mike Compton with some very impressive professional portfolios. So it's my intent with Where Eagles Dare to sort of celebrate some of these early photographers as well for their input, particularly in terms of making a very strong identity for the relaunched Eagle title. I think we will miss them.
Yes.
The photo strips on me.
Right. It's fascinating stuff. I mean, you know, as you say, you did a Doctor Who podcast, and there's a few of those, but there can't be, I think, any podcasts apart from yourself who are discussing the 1980s Eagles comic, particularly in such detail, and some of the fascinating strips that you've done and some of the fascinating strips you've got coming up in the future, I guess. Amazing stuff.
Mm. Now, as I say, really enjoying it, and we were surprised that no one else seemed to have sort of hit on this. Certainly the 2000 AD market is very, very successfully cornered we've been lucky, and it's been lovely to have some really good feedback and input from listeners as well.
And as you say, you're just finishing the photo strips era, and the merger with Scream is in your future at this point. Later on this year, Halloween time, and then The 13th Floor will arrive on Where Eagles Dare.
Yes, that and Monster. So those to look forward to. But with the as I say, with the change in format, it's almost like a jumping on point for new readers for Eagles. So Doom Lord, which had been a photo strip, is now about to be drawn, and Walk or Die will continue as a drawn strip. So it's like a second breath for Eagle, and really looking forward to it. It's a matter of days away, I think, for us recording wise. So lots to say.
Oh, splendid. And I did hear you both on Comic Scene podcast a couple of weeks ago talking about the Eagle, but also picking your own sort of classic and new comics, which was fascinating stuff as well. So yeah, check out the Comic Scene podcast as well, but also check out sofageddon.wordpress.com, or find you on Twitter at sofageddon.
That's correct, yes. And we're also on Facebook as well. We've got a reasonably active Facebook group under Where Eagles Dare.
So check out all these bits and pieces, and I will put those links in the show notes for this episode if anybody's looking to come and join in the fun with the Eagle and Where Eagles Dare. And you've had Conrad on the show as well.
We have, yes, and we hope to be talking with Philip again from Comic Scene this week when we talk about the photo strip flashback. So, Conrad's been great value. He's also had us back for Space Spinner Reaction, so God bless him.
Yes, indeed, yes. Great stuff. Space Spinner 2000 and Where Eagles Dare. Add them to your podcast feed if you haven't done so already, because they are fantastic. It's great stuff, Peter. Well done.
Thank you, man.
I mean, I know, you know, as we podcasters know, these things take a bit of work, but to produce them so regularly, and as, you know, I think as Stephen Reed pointed out recently, to be one of the funniest podcasts about on the subject of these great old comic strips, takes a lot of work, you know, and it's all worth it.
Well, it's been an honour and a pleasure to be on the Mega City Book Club as well, Aidan. So thank you again for this opportunity.
No, thanks for getting in touch, and thanks for picking The 13th Floor. What a gem. And particularly the fate of poor Harry Ferguson, which will stay with me for some time. We're going to cross.
He's sticking your neck out, isn't it?
Exactly. He has to stick his neck out to cross the rickety bridge, where I'm just going to, death is just going to use your head as a sort of a batarang, I guess.
Well said.
Splendid stuff. And thank you to everyone for listening to Mega City Book Club. Please like, subscribe and share in all the usual places. The podcast is on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram and the 2080 forums. Or, as Peter did, get in touch by emailing me at mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. And check out Where Eagles Dare at sofageddon.wordpress.com as well. So until next time on Mega City Book Club, when we're passing judgment on another fine 2080 book, it's time for goodbyes. So from here in Maxwell Towers in England, it's goodbye from me and...
And from the Eagle's Nest at the top of Maxwell Towers, it's good night from me.